This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Rachel was raised in a housing project in Brooklyn and now lives and works as an actor in London. The touring company of a gospel musical got him to London more than 10 years ago. He stayed on to appear in such productions as Miss Saigon, Jesus Christ Superstar, and Starlight Express. Back in the States in 1991, while on tour for a Lloyd Webber show, he got the idea for his first novel, Iced. While catching up with old friends from the neighborhood, he kept hearing the same story over and over again. Some of the best and brightest had become crack addicts. He was shocked. So Shell set about interviewing crack users around the country to find out why young men who had so much promise became 40-something addicts. Iced is written in the first person. It's the diary of a 44-year-old crack addict, Cornelius Washington Jr., as he reflects on his life. Rachel told me that although Cornelius is a composite character, he drew most on his old neighborhood buddy, who seemed most likely to succeed, but didn't.
You know, you always have one person in your neighborhood, your mom says, why can't you be like him? And he was the one that my mother used to always say, why can't you be like him? And I always thought that this guy was going to do, and he was the first in our neighborhood to go to college. He was the first to get a job outside of the neighborhood, because I lived in Brooklyn. He was in Manhattan. He was going to Columbia. This guy had it all. He was good looking. He was tall. He had all the girls, you know, things that I wanted. And then to see him now, at age 45, 47, it was just heartbreaking. I felt like somebody had died, and that freaked me out again, because I thought crack addicts were people like 15, 17, 18. And I found out that these were the kids who were selling it. And then it made more sense that I was wondering why the young black people here were so busy gangbanging and killing each other, but the people that they should be looking up to for support and direction, their fathers and their uncles and their big brothers, were involved in this drug, which made more sense. That part of it made sense to me.
When you talked to your friend, did you ask him what had happened to him, this person that had so much promise in your neighborhood?
Well, yes, I did, and it was hard having a conversation with him because he had moments of lucidity, and there were other moments where he was just going to flights of fancy. He would ask me, he'd been in the army, and he asked me, was my brother all right? Had they done anything to his brain? So I say, well, as far as I know, he's all right. I didn't, you know, and he kept talking about these people that would come in the night and take things away from him. And that's where I got the whole idea of the ghost people, because he would never admit to that he would never admit anything. He wouldn't admit that he had a problem. He wouldn't admit that there was something wrong. There were other people who did this to him. There were people that gave him the drug through certain means. He would never say that he went out and got it. So that's where I sort of got the whole idea about these ghost people and these people that sort of did things to people, to Cornelius, which in effect was that he was just denying the whole thing. It was just denial.
Well, the book you've written called Iced is written in the first person, written by someone you call Cornelius Washington Jr. He's addicted to crack. He's in his mid-40s, and the book is a kind of a diary. I'd like to have you read, actually, from the very beginning of the book to give us a feel for who this guy Cornelius is.
I'd love to. My sister lives down Brooklyn with her husband, the sucker who don't like me. I used to go down to her place and see her. I would jump the subway money thing and catch the train and go down and see her and get some money for the pipe man and see her. But she told me that her husband didn't want me coming around here. She would cry every time she saw me, cry all the time, like a woman. She would take my hand into hers and call me Junior. Junior, like she was trying to wake me up or something, and she tried to feed me. I was never hungry, not for chicken and rice. Lorraine, yeah, that's her name. She pays the rent in this place. She must pay it. She or my mama, because I don't pay it. And the ghost people ain't coming around to throw me out like they done to some of the other people that used to live around here. You must understand something first. It wasn't always like this. Things used to be up, so up. It's hard for me to tell you how up specifics escaped me. I see snapshot memories. My memories used to run across my mind like the movies, like a good fast movie like The French Connection. A whole block of memories got smudged or erased when the pipe time came. I don't know how it happened. Memories that used to hip-hop like angry roaches across my brain movie style slowed down to comic strip frames in a funny paper like peanuts. Now my memories come in snapshots one at a time. I really gotta concentrate to focus them in. Sometimes I feel like I'll just white out. There won't be no picture in my mind of anything. It'll just be white and black interference signals, like when the last picture of TV goes off.
That's Rachel reading from his novel called Iced. Well, in your novel, Cornelius is 16. He's accepted by Columbia University. This is part of his memories as he looks at his life. He wants to be a lawyer. He's his parents' pride and joy. He's got everything all set and going for him. Did you find that this was pretty true with a lot of the men that you talked to, is that they did have a number of things going for them?
Well, yes. I mean, I'd say one of the things I didn't say the last time about the similarities, this was the first time for most of us just being free. I wouldn't say we came from very, very, how can I say, stern backgrounds. My father was a Pentecostal minister, and most of the kids I was at school with, their parents were aspiring to be middle class. And we had two parents in the home, a mother and a father, and they expected things of us. They had very high expectations for us. Our lives were monitored. We were watched very, very closely in terms of what we did outside of the home. So to get into a situation like Boston, where there's all these students from all over the place, nobody telling you what time to go to bed, nobody telling you even to brush your teeth or anything, all this freedom, that was the first time in our lives that we had all this freedom just to do what we liked. And a lot of this freedom killed us.
Well, did you feel then like your parents were, and I understand, was your mother a Pentecostal minister too?
Both of them. They still are.
Okay. I mean, did they watch, monitor your every move?
Well, I had a balance. There were some things my mother would let me do that my father wouldn't, and then some things my father would let me do that my mother wouldn't. My mother didn't want me to go to school to be an actor, but my father was. He was my first director, so he encouraged it. My mother met my father because he was a Sunday school teacher. He's my stepfather, and he was my Sunday school teacher, so every time they had like a Father's Day or Christmas pageant, I had to be in it. So he was my first director, so he was thrilled when I got accepted into acting school, but my mother wanted me to be something like a doctor. My mother also didn't mind me going outside of the neighborhood and working and just seeing what the world was like. He probably would have preferred me to be a little bit closer to home, but he understood it. So I was able to have a balance. I've been like flying around the world since I was 15 years old. So I tend to think they prepared me for what I'm doing now. That's why my son is with me here as well, so he can actually see the life that I came from. So I was very blessed in that my parents were strict, but at the same time, they were very, very liberal in terms of letting me get out in the world and see that there was a world outside of Lewis H. Pink houses.
Do you think that explains why you're okay, at least in terms of you didn't smoke crack and have been able to kind of follow this dream of yours to be an actor?
Well, I think, honestly speaking, I think the thing that saved my life was going to England, because I say if I had been in London, I mean, if I had been in Boston along with my friends and had been around my friends, like I said, you don't expect your friends to kill you or hurt you. And again, we like to get high. Getting high to us was a way of keeping one foot in the ghetto, if you understand what I mean. We'd go home from school and, here comes the college boys. They think they know everything. Here's something new. Have you tried this? So to be down with our friends, to be down with our peers, getting high was a way of saying, okay, I'm going to college, but I'm down with you, and I'm going to do this with you. I could have been very easily a Cornelius myself because at that time, like I said, when the price went up, nobody did it. The whole thing was cocaine. And from after cocaine, it was crack. So I don't have any illusions about saying that I was stronger or better or anything like that. I tend to think I was in England. It wasn't there. I was involved with Lloyd Webber. And I was very, very lucky. The musical theater shifted over to England for some weird reason. So I just happened to be there when things like Starlight Express happened, which I was part of the original company, and Miss Saigon and Five Games. Five Guys Named Mo. I was just very lucky and blessed to have been in England at that time. But had I been here, there's no telling what would have happened.
Well, let me have you read another section from the book. And again, this is the book is called Iced, and it's a kind of a diary kept by a man named Cornelius Washington Jr. He's in his mid-40s, and he's addicted to crack, and it's written by our guest today on Fresh Air, Rachel.
I couldn't sleep. Sleep deprivation sucks. I started hallucinating after working 5 days in a row and not sleeping at night, smoking all night. Big time hallucinations. I would be ladling chicken noodle soup into a bowl, and the noodles would turn into 40 skinny white Diana Rosses, snake dancing out of the ladle, shimmering into the soup bowl, screeching, "Stop in the name of love," loudly. Of course, I dropped the ladle in the bowl, howling with terrified mirth. A white Jewish lady with blue-gray hair sat down at one of my booths. She was wearing one of those blue-gray fox wraps that have fox or chinchilla heads with teeth on one end and claws and feet at the other end. This lady must have gave me her wrap and asked me to hang it up. I know that she must have handed it to me, but it seemed to me that the blue-gray beady-eyed fox thing jumped out of her hand, snarling and barking at me. I wrestled the chinchilla fox thingy to the floor, screaming like a deranged Cherokee, trying my level best to stomp the beady-eyed teeth-bearing fiend to death. The blue-gray Jewish lady was mortified. She sued. Of course I was fired. That was back in the mid-80s, I think. It had to be around that time because that was a time when I was doing all those weird jobs. Money to live, I told myself. I didn't acknowledge my addiction. Piping was a pastime for me. I hadn't taken it up as a full-time occupation. I wasn't in love. I wasn't infatuated. I was having an affair. We hadn't gotten married.
That section you just read is both funny and so tragic at the same time because, of course, this Cornelius is his losing it. I mean, he's not his grip on reality is disappearing. But on the other hand, you could almost take this as a comedic scene.
Yeah. Well, I felt that I didn't want to have something that people would want to slit their wrists to. And I felt that I had to balance it with some funny elements. I mean, after talking with the guys, I found out that there were just some horrific things that had happened to them. And so horrific that I didn't think anybody would believe it. So just talking to the people just gave me a circle of events that, an arena or a boundary of events that what was possible under the drug and what was possible was almost anything as long as you had there was a reason to get to that.
Well, certainly you've spent many years as an actor and this is your first novel. Did you feel that you had to become Cornelius to be able to write about him?
Well, that's what I had to do. I mean, sometimes it was really funny because I'd be writing backstage between acts, and the first act, and the first song in the second act was Evita, and I'd be taking Cornelius on stage singing Evita, baring my teeth. My kids were saying, "Ray, what is wrong with you?" And I would laugh because I'd forget that I was still in character, and you know, I would be running around and in the hotel room while they'd be out partying and stuff, just my little diary, just scribbling things away, and they'd say, "We saw you talking to someone weird people last night. Maybe you should be careful about this." And then when I explained to them what I was doing, they're saying, "Wow, that's interesting." So now, 2 years later, seeing the book in the shops and everything, the cast remembers what I was going through then. So I tend to think I have Andrew Lloyd Webber to thank for this book, quite frankly.
Well, my guest today on Fresh Air is Ray Schell. He is an actor and a singer and now a novelist. He's just written his first novel. It's called Iced. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ray Schell is our guest today, and he is an actor, lives in England, and has just published his first novel, and it's called Iced. Let me ask you a little bit about growing up in Brooklyn, and you said that both your parents were Pentecostal ministers. How often would you go to church in a week?
All the time.
Every day?
Not every day. It started, let's say, on Friday nights. We had Friday night service. Saturday was like choir rehearsal and prayer. We had tarrying service on Saturday nights because tarrying was like getting the Holy Ghost. You had to stay and tarry and wait for the Holy Spirit to become part of your life. Sunday was all-day affair. We might be able to have to go to church on Wednesday night for Bible study. So it might be, it was definitely Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If there was a service, a special service, and we were in the choir and we were expected to sing, it might be Tuesday and Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Well, did you ever want to go out and play baseball with your friends?
Yes, of course I did. It was fine up until I was about 13 and 14 when I discovered girls and then just found out that there were friends of mine who were doing other things on the weekends, like sneaking off to clubs and stuff like that. And then when I started working in May's department store at about 16, I would create reasons why I couldn't go to church that night. I had to work late or a friend of mine wanted me to help me with his homework or we had to study for SATs. And then I would sneak off to, let's say, the Bonsoir and see Barbra Streisand. Or I would get my high school had these tickets whereby you could get to see a Broadway show. And that's how I fell in love with Broadway. They would give us these tickets that if a show wasn't selling out, we could go and watch it. And I think the first thing I saw was Lee Remick's Wait Until Dark at the Music Box Theater. So my mother, when she found out that that's the kind of things I was doing, and I wasn't really hanging out in the street and getting in trouble, she didn't mind me spending less time at church. I remember on our prom night, I ran out of money. So here is me going up to my father's church with this big white limo remember seeing, and my father was in the middle of a prayer line praying for everybody, and I had to stand in the prayer line about five people in front of me. And then when I got up to him and he was about to anoint me, I said, "Daddy, I need some money." So
did he give it to you?
He prayed for me, and then he gave me the money and came outside and met my friends. But it was like the most, and they were sitting in the car saying, "Well, what is he doing in there?" And I had to stand in the prayer line and get my anointing and then get the money and then leave.
Well, now, you said it was having these tickets to Broadway that kind of, I guess, got you the acting bug.
Yeah.
What was it about, I guess, seeing some of these big plays on Broadway that appealed to you so much?
Well, I had never seen, you're sitting in an audience, the lights goes down, a curtain raises, and you're in a different world. I mean, I had never seen, I had never been backstage, so I didn't know that behind this scenery were sandbags, and it was just painted scenery. They all looked so lifelike and so real, and the people on stage were so comfortable, and as if we weren't there, it felt like I was eavesdropping on somebody else's life. And then to find out that people actually got paid to do that, and they had to do it 8 times a week, it was just intriguing. It was a world I had never seen before. So that I wanted to be a part of that, and it echoed back to my little Sunday school pageants. But to actually find this big, beautiful building with all these people, glamorous people, you know, with minks and everything, sitting in the audience, watching these people on stage, I wanted to do that. That's what I wanted to do.
How did you get over to England?
Well, I'm in the book. I wrote myself into Skeets, the guy that couldn't string two sentences together. And I was sitting, it happened that way. I was sitting at the Hotel Operatic, which is a condominium now. And I was reading backstage, and I had a few people, friends over, and it said I needed an actor to do a show that would have a national tour and then would go on to London. So I just left and said, "Look, I got to go to this audition." And I got there. If I had been like 5 minutes late, I wouldn't be sitting here now, because they were about to go to Philadelphia to start the auditions. And I couldn't go because I didn't have the money. I said, "Look, you got to audition me here." And they did, and they gave me the part. We toured America for a year, and the show got to England.
What was the play? What was the show?
It was called Little Willie Jr.'s Resurrection. And we had our premiere at the Walnut Street Theater. And after getting to England, we didn't know that Little Willie was a euphemism for a male's anatomy. And I was Little Willie, and my father was Big Willie. And we'd have all these men in raincoats in their laps during the first act. And then the second act, they'd all be gone. And we were at the same theater that Let My People Come was at. So we didn't find, they thought it was a sex show. So,
but you didn't.
We didn't
know.
You
had no idea.
We hadn't. And then when it was a gospel musical, and when they were sitting there looking perplexed during the entire first act, I guess they were waiting for us to take our clothes off or something. And when we didn't, they left after that. So we didn't last very long.
I know that you've performed in a number of Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals. What did his work offer you as both a singer and an actor?
Well, he gave me an opportunity. I was a totally unknown to him. I was teaching acting and voice at this time. I had given up all hopes of really being in theater because I didn't see it happening over there. I was an American actor, and I didn't have a British accent at the time. I can actually do one now if I have to. But, I mean, I didn't have one then. So when I auditioned, I was teaching acting and voice, and one of my students had went to audition, and he didn't get it. And he said, "Well, Mr. Shell, you're always telling us to try things. Why don't you go and try?" And I said, "Well, I'm not very young, and I hadn't roller skated in 20 years. But I will go to this audition, but I won't tell my students, because if I don't get it, they're not going to want anybody to teach them who can't get a job himself." And I remember I went down to 2 auditions, and in the second audition, Trevor Nunn and Andrew Lloyd Webber got up and put their arms around me, and they offered me the lead. And it was the changing of my whole career, my whole life.
And that was Starlight Express.
That was Starlight
Express. If you're
talking
about roller skates, right?
Yeah, and I played the lead role. I played Rusty. In fact, it's weird because people here in this country have probably heard me on record and didn't even know it was me, because I didn't get to do the Broadway production. I was doing Jesus Christ Superstar, and the London production of Starlight Express is still running in London because it was a very different production from the one that was done on Broadway. But the Broadway production only lasted less than a year. I tend to think if they had brought me over and kept the production the way it was in London, it probably would still be running. But the economics of American theater are very different, so they're able to take a lot more chances than they are here.
Reading through your novel, Iced, I got the feeling that this could be turned very easily into a performance piece. Have you thought about that? Have you done it?
Well, we have done it. I've just done 2 25-minute pieces in Atlanta, and I performed it at PS 122 earlier in June. And we have a British producer, William Butler Slough, who wants me to develop it into a full evening's theater, which is what I want to do. I've got to do the second novel. I'm working on the second novel now. And we've also had film option offers from Bill Duke and a man called, I can't remember his name. I should know his name, but so much has happened since this has started. So there are offshoots that are happening, and I'm still trying to be very cool about it all. But I keep feeling like I want to jump up and down and go, yay!
When you performed this for PS 122, was that a high school?
No, it's a performance space in on the east side in New York.
Okay.
It used to be a school. It was a school, and they've taken it and made it into a performance space, an amazing place. It was really, really interesting. I felt like I was going back to school, and it was just unusual that it's like a more funkier kind of public theater, New York Public Theater, Joseph Papp's old place.
Sure.
And it's a smaller performance space, but you're able to develop things without the pressure of commercial eyes. And once you have a piece ready to be seen by reviewers, and then that's when they bring them in.
What was the audience reaction like?
Shocked.
Shocked, yeah.
Even my sisters had never seen me say some of those things. They'd never seen me do some of those things. They were shocked. But that, I said, well, that's part of what's written into it. I like to just shock people into realizing that the people that they pass in the streets have lives, were people, used to be somebody, have dreams and ambitions. And I tend to think that sometimes America, we can get so used to hopelessness. We get so used to seeing the bad things. There's so much bad news about that we forget that the people involved suffer. It's the news of what's happened to the person becomes more important than the people themselves. And so, if anything, I just hope people can actually look at ICE and remember that these people do have lives and hopes and dreams.
Rachelle is an actor. Her first novel is called Iced. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.